This is Phil Davidson, and with me today is Rockford Symphony Orchestra Music Director Stephen Larson. And we're not discussing a specific concert today, but rather we're looking at the orchestra itself. You know, in many of these podcasts, we discuss the music that's to be performed, but now why don't we talk about who actually performs that musical, that music?
That's a good idea.
The musicians. Are they all local? And I suspect they aren't. And if not, where do they come from?
A minority are local. I'd say probably we have, it sort of varies a little bit, maybe 6 to 10 actually from the Rockford area. Another 3 or 4 or 5 that come from as far as DeKalb or that vicinity. We used to have some people out in Stillman Valley and don't have any more. But most of them come from the greater Chicago area, particularly the western suburbs, although some as far as Evanston. And I always discourage people from Evanston into auditioning for the orchestra, because I said, you really can't get to Evanston from Rockford. It's just really difficult. But somebody comes from Madison. Our principal trombone player is from up north of Milwaukee.
Wow.
So he probably has the record. No, I think the record actually goes to one of our second violins who comes from Peoria.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's a healthy drive.
It is.
Are they all professionals?
Well, it depends on how you define professional. The only full-time musician in the orchestra is me. Everybody else is distinctly part-time. We pay them by the concert. Then you burrow a little bit farther into that term and say, well, what does professional mean? All of them are professional in the sense that they have had musical educations, probably bachelor's degrees at least in performance, or sometimes music education on their instruments. Some of them have master's degrees. As far as what they do for a living, well, that kind of goes all over the map.
Mm-hmm. I imagine it does. Do any of them teach?
Quite a few of them teach. Some of them, it's their principal job. We have a couple people who are a full-time high school orchestra director in different school districts. Rachel Handlin, who is our assistant concertmaster, is the principal teacher at the Music Academy of Rockford. She's their number one violin teacher. They've been there for a number of years. And her husband, Mike Beard, the principal cellist, is the head of the music department at Rock Valley College, mm-hmm. teaches there full-time. A lot of other people have private studios. They just do private lessons. Some of them teach for school districts. Some of them just teach in their home.
So you probably have some people playing in an orchestra and a lot of other professions, maybe lawyers, maybe doctors, this type of thing?
We don't have any doctors because we did actually at one time, but the hours tend to be sort of demanding.
Of course.
Although I find that there are a lot of doctors out there who are very, very good musicians. I'd say that a typical member of the orchestra falls into either two categories. Either they are young, in their 20s, maybe that they're out of college, they're looking for a permanent orchestra job, they're doing a lot of auditioning, and they're playing in as many orchestras as they can. The second category are people who started out in that mode and got married and perhaps thought they needed a little bit more secure income and decided to get into a different field. So now they're doing something else and playing in the orchestra as much as they can. We have engineers, we have nurses, or at least had a couple of nurses. Our third trumpet owns a woodworking business, very, very busy there. One of our cellists is an engineer. We've actually had a couple of different engineers. Then there are people like Doug Bristow, who's one of our bass players, who's a very busy jazz musician in Chicago, has a recording studio in his home, and does a lot of work there. You go down the section and start looking at people and say, okay, well, that's an interesting story. One of our violists this year, who is the daughter of our second flute player, got her first orchestra job. Her very first orchestra job was with the Rockford Symphony. Mm. And she also plays in the Elgin Symphony. So another category, I like to call these people the road warriors, people who play in many different orchestras, as many as they can, and sometimes logging 200,000 miles a year in their cars.
Oh, my gosh.
Driving back and forth from one orchestra to another. I think some of them enjoy it. Some of them are looking for something a little bit more stable, but got to admire them.
Absolutely. So how are musicians selected to be in the symphony?
Strictly by audition. When we get an opening, we advertise for that position, usually in the publications of the Musicians Union, sometimes in colleges, billboards in the big music schools around the Chicago area. Sometimes just word of mouth. People will say, a violinist will say to somebody they're playing with another orchestra, well, you know, we have an opening in the Rockford Symphony. Why don't you audition? And so they come. We have a formal audition process here. The first round is a blind audition. The judges are behind screens, and we don't know who's playing. We just can hear them. And then for the final, we get to actually see who they are. For this audition, we select probably 8 or 10 different orchestral excerpts that are very difficult and require great musicianship to be able to play, and ask them to play at least the first part of a movement of a standard concerto for their instrument.
Wow. So they go through quite a process there. That's why they're all so good.
Well, the audition process is kind of a... it's something that they actually have classes in this now in college, you know, how to take an audition and how to prepare for an audition. Because, as you can imagine, nerves are quite a factor, being able to just settle down and perform. And, you know, going into an audition, knowing that one wrong note might mean the difference of not getting the job. And then knowing that you could play your absolute best and still not get the job because they just liked somebody better. Mm-hmm. Not that the other person was better, but they liked that person better. They liked the way that they played better. It's a very frustrating, certainly, and psychologically taxing part of being a musician is handling the audition.
Do they make a commitment to play for the entire season?
We'd like them to. Before the season starts, we offer them whatever concerts that are available to them, and they can choose to a certain number that they maybe won't play. They have a conflict somewhere else. After a certain point, we say, well, you know, if you really want to be part of this orchestra, you've got to maybe step up and just play a little bit more, because if you don't play, that means that the personnel manager has to find a substitute. Mm-hmm. And that means getting on the phone or getting on the internet and calling a list of people until you find somebody.
So there's a waiting list that could cover those openings.
Yeah, we have a personnel manager who keeps that list, and I'm sure it's very, very extensive. Part of that list are people that are recommended by the principals of each section. Part of that list are people who have auditioned and done well but didn't get the job. And part of that list are just friends, people that he or she has played with. It's he in this case, John Floater, one of our basses. You know, you play different concerts, you notice that somebody is particularly good, or you've sat next to somebody who is a very strong player, and you say, hey, give me your phone number. I want to keep you on my sub list. It's a lot of word of mouth.
I'm sure there is. So leading up to a concert, what would be a typical schedule for a musician and concerning rehearsals and that sort of thing?
Well, this is what really surprises a lot of people, because would it be 3 weeks before a concert and somebody will say to me, well, you're busy rehearsing? No. Well, when do you rehearse? I said, well, we have our first rehearsal 6 days before the performance, typically.
Well, that is surprising.
We perform on Saturdays most often. The first rehearsal is usually Sunday evening. And then there are three other rehearsals, two during the week, and a dress rehearsal is usually Saturday afternoon. Each rehearsal is 2.5 hours, and with a 20-minute break in between, in the middle. So that the person who expects that we're going to be rehearsing constantly or every week or something like that is probably used to more of an amateur situation where I, the conductor, I'm teaching people the music. We're drilling the music. We're doing it a little faster. And okay, let's try clapping the rhythm now. And that sort of stuff that if you've been part of a band or amateur band or chorus or something, you're quite familiar with. No, everybody comes in knowing their parts right from the very beginning. And of course, that means that there is a fair amount of practicing that will go on
at home. So they're at home practicing.
Right. I mean, we some of the music we do is among the most difficult. We have never shied away from doing a piece of music because it was too difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we have to grit our teeth and say, okay, this is going to take a little more work for this concert than usual. But we do the best music we can find. And sometimes if it's very difficult, well, that's more of a challenge.
Well, that's cool. I think that's cool that you do difficult ones. Now, without getting into specifics, obviously, are the musicians compensated based on hourly system or per concert or?
Oh, we have two levels, basically. We have the section players and the principal players. The principal players are the first oboe, the first clarinet, mm-hmm. the first bassoon, first of all the strings except for the first violin. We have a special name for that. We call it the concertmaster.
Right.
The principals all get a higher pay rate than everybody else, and the concertmaster gets more than everybody else does. That's a very, very competitive and, of course, very, very important job. Some orchestras, not so much anymore, but they'll pay more for concerts than rehearsals. We don't do that, and I don't think most orchestras do that. If you show up to play, you know, you're working pretty hard in the rehearsal just as you are in the performance, so you should get paid the same for both.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Now, since everyone seems to dress similarly at a concert, I assume there's some sort of dress code. Anything in particular?
Yeah, well, each orchestra will have its own dress code, and sometimes for specific concerts. Definitely for specific concerts. We have a different dress code, for instance, for outdoor concerts, for mm-hmm. summer concerts, than we do in the concert hall. We have a dress code that probably most orchestras adopt, and basically kind of the black tuxedo look for men and a simple black dress or pantsuit for women. You know, no contrasting colors, no bangles or stuff like that. Just basically, the idea is to kind of to blend into a big black mass on stage, and but while looking fairly formal. And some people are trying to get away from that, and I think probably actually we would too, except that it's so easy to standardize something when you just tell people, you know, black jackets or tuxes, yes. and black bow ties and white shirts.
Right.
If you say something else, well, you know, I don't have that, and I have to go out and buy it, and that gets complicated. A lot of professional orchestras, that most of the real top orchestras still dress in white tie and tails for the men. And then the women say black, just a black dress, black pants, pantsuit. We have to be a little specific because there's always somebody out there, no tennis shoes, you know, black socks, please.
No argyles.
Yeah. But if you get up close, sometimes you might be amazed at what you see. We had a guy in the orchestra, and I won't mention his name, played with us for a number of years. He was very frugal. And at some point, he ripped the leg of his tux pants. And rather than go out and buy another pair, he just patched it up with black duct tape. And since he played in the back of the orchestra, nobody ever saw it. And I remember one time going to the Chicago Symphony when I was younger, and I was sitting in the front row by the first violins, and I could look up at them and kind of see the little holes in the fraying and their tuxes and things. you couldn't tell that from a distance, but up close,
They had a few years on them. Huh? Is there any difference in dress for the pop series over the classical series?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Occasionally, like for holiday pops, we supply red bow ties for the men, and women are encouraged to wear a colorful scarf or something like that, or just as long as it's basically solid colors. Sometimes, particularly if we're doing a movie where we want the stage to be as dark as possible, we'll tell everybody that we're all black, so there's no white in the stage, no white clothing at all in the stage. And of course, if we're outdoors, short sleeve white shirts or white blouses that's allowed. We've experimented with polo shirts and khaki pants and things like that, and you wouldn't believe there are people who don't own khaki pants.
I can't believe that.
And it becomes an issue. So, okay, forget it. We'll go black pants, white shirts. Doesn't really matter that much.
So let's go back to the concertmaster and the principals. How are they chosen?
The principals are chosen the same way the rest of the players are, except that they might have a few additional excerpts thrown at them. And, of course, they're held to somewhat of a higher standards. Sometimes we may have a principal candidate play together with somebody else in the section, part of the auditions, just to see what kind of chemistry is there. For the concertmaster, it's much more rigorous because any principal will at times have solos. Yeah, the oboe will have more of them than probably most people. The flute will have a number of them. But the concertmaster has almost every concert, there'll be at least one or two solos, some of them very, very extensive, and some of them extremely extensive and extremely difficult. So you really have to have an absolute top-notch player for the first violin. So in addition to that movement of a concerto we've asked for and some orchestral excerpts, we also throw at them many of the well-known and difficult concert excerpts. The violin solo of the Brahms, second movement of the Brahms First Symphony, the violin solo in Scheherazade, Rimsky-Korsakov, and any exposed, very, very difficult passage like that. We just want to see how they handle it under pressure.
Mm-hmm. Now, within each section, I assume that the players are sitting in a certain order. Who determines what order?
That's a good question. In the wind and brass section, you are not just a flutist, an oboist, a bassoonist. You are the second flute or the second oboe, second bassoon, the third horn or the fourth horn. You have a number assigned to your name. That doesn't change unless you're subbing for the first player and then you move up to the first chair in the absence of the principal player. That's not true for the string section. After that first stand, the concertmaster, maybe the assistant concertmaster on that first stand of first violins, then everybody is seated, by some plan or another. Mm-hmm. Sometimes on a concert-to-concert basis, and sometimes more or less permanently. If people look up on stage, you notice that the strings are seated two by two, exception of the basses, which we sit on stools. So that's got some interesting history behind that and interesting duties because when you're playing and a page turn comes, it's the duty of the inside player, the player towards the back of the stage, to reach up and turn that page.
Oh, really?
So that player stops playing for a few seconds and turns the page. Now, it's the duty of the outside player to play a little bit stronger while the inside player is not playing. And it's the duty of the inside player, of course, to get that page turn done expeditiously and not screw it up. And there can be a lot of friction between people if that doesn't happen. People don't get along with each other sitting next to each other because they have to interact. They listen to each other. They have to imitate the way the other is playing. And so that gets taken into consideration. Do people get along with each other? Because you just don't want people fighting or unhappy. So that's thought of. Sometimes you put stronger players at the back of the section because you want a stronger sound coming from the back. Sometimes, in our case, all our players really are, frankly, very strong. We can shuffle them around how we want to. And sometimes it's because so-and-so has got a good chemistry with somebody, so they sit together a lot. Sometimes it's because you know that somebody's going to be missing for a rehearsal. So if that person is going to be missing a rehearsal, you don't want them on the outside because then somebody else is going to have to move over and do that. So you put them on the inside. Lots of little things like that. Sometimes I have an input into this. I will say I like the section arranged this certain way. More often, the principal string player of the concertmaster will say that, I'd like to have these people behind me and you order the section that way.
Well, this is there's a lot more to this than the average person realizes.
You can imagine that in a violin section where you have like we'll have maybe 12 first violins and 10 second violins. You've got 22 people there. And they're all playing, 12 people are playing the same part, 10 people the same part. And sometimes they're all playing the same thing because the parts are together. You have a lot of different opinions.
Oh, I can imagine.
And one of the great, the big decisions that have to be made about any piece is bowing. Do you a down bow here? Do you do an up bow? Do you link notes together? Do you not link notes together? Now, this is ultimately the concertmaster's responsibility, and if the concertmaster says so, you do it this way. However, you can disagree. And you can say either during rehearsal or during the break, I don't think this bowing really works. Why don't we try this? And so everybody usually has some opinion about bowing. And that they'd like to share. And so there's a lot of discussion that goes on about this during rehearsals. You see, any time the rehearsal, I stop during a rehearsal, inevitably the concertmaster will be turning around and talking to people in the section about how this is going to be bowed or how that's going to be bowed.
Oh, this is amazing. Well, thanks for enlightening us on the musicians. Remember, the new season begins here really pretty soon. So don't miss your opportunity to enjoy one of Rockford's true gems, the Rockford Symphony Orchestra. To learn more about season tickets and other information, go to rockfordsymphony.com or call 815-965-0049. This is Phil Davidson.
And this is Steve Larson.
Thank you for listening.